Simon Saunders is Professor of Philosophy of Physics at the University of Oxford, specialising in foundations of quantum mechanics, symmetries in space-time, and relativistic quantum theory. In this interview and discussion, he addresses how the question of why does anything exist at all is a valid scientific and philosophical question, as well as discusses some of the conceptual problems behind probability theory in quantum mechanics. Simon, my first question would be, why does anything exist at all? How can we think about this question, and how can quantum mechanics help us at least attempt to address and understand this question?
The question has been something of a torment to some philosophers. Other philosophers don't find it a troubling one. I think myself, I'm a realist in general outlook, and part of, I think, being a realist is that one doesn't set boundaries to explanations. It may be that there are boundaries, but they don't seem to be good arguments as to why there have to be boundaries to explanation. So the name of the game, it seems to me, is that one does push virtually any meaningful question that one can express, and one may or may not get anywhere with it. So in a certain sense, this question, why anything at all, I mean, it certainly looks like a meaningful question, and one would hope to be able to at some point eventually, who knows, say something informative about it. Now, interestingly, quantum mechanics does seem to change the nature of the problem, and that's very much bound up not so much with non-relativistic quantum mechanics. The quantum theory is applied to in the low velocity limit, the quantum mechanics of atoms and molecules and so forth, but in relativistic theory, when you marry quantum theory and relativity together, what comes out is not a particle theory, but a quantum theory. Of course, a quantum field theory has particle aspects, but it is fundamentally different from any non-relativistic particle theory, let me put it like that. And one of the most fascinating features about a quantum field theory, relativistic quantum field theory, is the nature of the vacuum state. So I think it's very natural when you ask the question, why is there anything at all, that the alternative, as it were, is nothingness. And that nothingness, I think we tend to conceive of it as actually a three-dimensional space-time with nothing in it. I'm not at all sure that we can really conceive of the absence of time altogether. Perhaps we can conceive of the absence of space. But this is the sort of background, a kind of an implicit presuppositions of questions like this. You know, you say, imagine there's nothing. And I think most people imagine emptiness, but it's empty space. Now, if you try to do that in quantum field theory, the nearest we've got to nothingness in that case is the vacuum state. But the vacuum state in a relativistic quantum field theory is a very curious, remarkable state. It, in some level, contains everything. And I know that's going to sound extremely paradoxical, but it's bound up with some of the peculiarities of quantum theory, that quantum theory, states in quantum theory obey the superposition principle, so one can always superpose different states. So you can superpose a state of a particle located in one part of space with a state of that same particle in another part of space. In some sense, that superposition describes the particle as being in both places at once, and that's very problematic, and it's a source of a number of the conceptual problems in quantum theory. Now, I'm going to bracket those conceptual problems for a moment, and just think again, think more on this notion of superposition. The vacuum state of a relativistic quantum field, in a certain sense, it consists of a superposition of all local possibilities. When I say local possibilities, I mean any configuration of quantum fields that is locally described and locally definable. And the fact that the vacuum state does have this extraordinary structure to it, that it is the superposition of local state of affairs, if you like, all possible superpositions, means that in a certain sense, one's to say the vacuum contains all possibilities in a superposition. So it isn't really a nothingness. okay, so, I mean, for those, in case there are listeners who know a bit about this, what I have in mind here is the Riesz-Schlieder theorem, which states that one can, applying a local projector to the vacuum, you can project out with non-zero amplitude, virtually any local configuration of particles or fields that you like. Okay, so if we just step back a moment, I think what this means is that there are certain ways of, and I'm now connecting back with the puzzles of quantum theory, and in particular the problem of measurement in quantum mechanics, that it may well be that the correct state of the universe actually is a vacuum state, and that we and all that we see around us, the visible universe indeed, is one component entering into a vast superposition that, taken all together, gives you the vacuum state. That is extraordinary, kind of mad, but seems to be a possibility. And of course, in a way, whether or not quantum field theory, relativistic quantum field theory, is a correct theory or a true theory, I mean, what this is illustrating is that there are certain kinds of law-like universes. I mean, just think of it in terms of possible worlds. This is how philosophers usually think of it, where it may be relativistic quantum field theory is not a correct theory of our world, but where relativistic quantum field theory is a correct theory of that possible world. And in that possible world, the question, why is there something rather than nothing, has some sort of an answer to it, namely that the nearest you can get to nothingness is actually something which is filled with structure. Okay, so let me just, though, now put the negative. The negative of this is that, well, when people ask, you know, something, why is there something rather than nothing, they can also have in mind why three-dimensional space rather than nothing at all, or why time rather than nothing at all. And of course, then you can ask why a relativistic quantum field theory rather than nothing at all. And the fact that the nearest you can get to nothingness in a relativistic quantum field theory, namely the vacuum state, actually contains a vast amount of structure to it, in a sense, it's only pushing that point, you know, namely, why would the laws be like that? Why should there be laws at all? Why not real nothingness, the absence of laws as well, the absence of the vacuum state, if you like, the absence of quantum fields? And I think at that point, quantum mechanics just really isn't adding anything to the situation in a classical theory or any other theory that anybody's ever had. Because if the issue is why are there laws, why are there laws like this rather than some other sorts of laws, why Minkowski space-time structure, why relativistic, and so forth, why quantum, you know, then one really doesn't have an answer to those sorts of questions. I mean, this is a topic of what has becoming, I think, quite a well-known debate between Larry Krauss and David Albert, where Krauss has very much pushed the line that the vacuum state in relativistic quantum theory is, you know, I mean, it's the nearest you can get to nothing, but lo and behold, it's got everything. And Albert's riposte is, look, this question taken seriously is also the question of why are there any laws at all? And then, of course, Krauss has nothing to add. Having said all of that, there's another line altogether that I think it would be appropriate to mention at this point. So in a way, this has got nothing to do with quantum mechanics now. And it's really the notion of a necessary existent being. And there are views out there. I find them they're clearly extraordinary. They make for a surprisingly coherent package. The view out there being that all mathematical structures exist in the same sense as tables and chairs exist, in the same sense as, I mean, of course, we got to step back. How can one talk about a mathematical thing existing in the same sense as a material thing existing? Okay, so suppose, take the visible universe, the material universe that we know and love. Now, that is well described by a mathematical structure, the standard model. We can imagine filling out a description. Of course, this is always schematic insofar as it's any kind of a construct by human beings, but one can construct a schematic description of the universe in terms of the standard model and so forth. And that description is a mathematical structure. We say that mathematical structure represents reality. But what if that mathematical structure actually just is reality? So that's an astonishing suggestion, but even more astonishing is to add, and what's more, every kind of mathematical structure is its own reality. So this makes, you know, things like Manywell's theory and other extravagances of contemporary physics really look small, because now one's talking about every conceivable mathematical structures. And the point about a mathematical structure, of course, is that in many views of mathematics, philosophy of mathematics, mathematical truths are necessary truths. So whatever a mathematical structure, as it were, how it is structured, whatever that structure is, it's necessarily in that way and not in some other way. And there's all sorts of worries now about, well, what individuates mathematical structures? You know, how does one method get to be different from another? You know, can I just a little bit? And if I am able to tweak it a little bit, then in what sense is what I've just tweaked necessarily true? So, you know, there are a host of questions here that come crowding in. But it does seem that now we really do have purchase on the issue of why something rather than nothing, because at some level, at least, I think we can make sense of mathematics as a body of necessary truths. So perhaps the real crucial aspect now to this kind of line of reasoning is, in what sense can a mathematical structure be physically real, in the sense that tables and chairs are physically real? I don't have a lot to say about that, but I have a little bit, and that's this, that we know, and it's been the case since the 17th century, that qualitative experience, often called qualia, seem to have very little to do with the physical world as we conceive it, according to, and this is how it first arose with the scientific revolution, according to mechanism. So the mechanistic worldview that took over the scientific world, or partly created the scientific world, really, in the 17th century, replaces a world of colours and smells and feels and tastes, a world of particles moving in vacuum. And those particles moving in vacuum really don't seem to have the characteristics that adult experience has. So people sometimes talk about the manifest image in contrast to the objective account of reality offered by physical science. So it seems the manifest image is very much bound up with the mind-body problem, is bound up with the way our neural structures work, the way that we process data impacting upon us. Okay, and this is an old story, and I think well known to everyone. You know, take colours. Colours, in some sense, are frequencies of light. Actually, they can't just be frequencies of light. I mean, there's no frequency of lights corresponding to brown, for example. One can't produce brown light, you know. So in some sense, this is only a fragment of the picture, the full picture. But even if we just run with this and think of colours as being frequencies of light, so these frequencies and radiation itself, that's not how I understand greenness or blueness or redness. The felt experience of seeing something blue or green or red doesn't seem to be the same, doesn't seem to be characterized in terms of frequencies of light. So we nevertheless, and many physicists will do this too, and I think it's probably a good method, we say, well, colors do exist, they are out there in the world, it's just they're not quite what we thought they were. And there's another thing that people do, and now this is people who don't know much science, they think the colours are out there in the world just like we think they are. So those people who think colours are out there in the world just like we think they are, and so are smells, you know, and the flowers and the roses just like we think they are, feels maybe, you know, they're all sort of out there, the tastes that we taste, they're in the actual food, they're in the fruits, objectively out there. In some sense, that's all a mistake. And I don't think one's making a greater mistake in supposing that what is out there is mathematical structures.
And that would be, even if you're, that sounds almost like an anti-realist position or a position of internal realism from Putnam, but if all that's out there that's mathematical structure, and then we're interpreting that from that, that's still, from your perspective, playing into a realist position, because at least the structure of mathematics is out there.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I think this is not a moderate form of realism at all. I think it's a pretty radical, almost a...
the ultra-aggressive form, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Max Tegmark has championed this, that all mathematical structures are real. There's another aspect of this, though, the idea that mathematical structures might be real and that tables and chairs just are mathematical structures. There's another aspect to it, which is that, how could a mathematical structure support consciousness? But again, I think the situation vis-a-vis so-called material structures, particles moving about in vacuum, that's a classical picture, of course, not the quantum mechanical one. Quantum mechanical one is much more interesting, but that classical picture of material particles interacting with one another, how on earth does that support consciousness? It seems to me that one's no better off in thinking that, well, at least it's a material reality that somehow brings you closer to consciousness. I don't really think it does. I mean, the mathematical structure seems just as good as a way of for consciousness to come about. You know, it's associated with some mathematical structure. So all of this is all, it's all kind of crazy and wild. But I think it does show that the question of why does something exist rather than nothing, I mean, there are answers to it. They're just very, very wild answers that, you know, make hypotheses really that perhaps seem a bit mad, but certainly many people find them intelligible, and some even find them persuasive.
But you're quite comfortable accepting that it is a valid question. Some even deny that it makes logical sense, that in a metaphysical sense, for example, someone like Adolf Grumbum or Anthony Grayling would say it doesn't make sense, like asking what colour is the number four, that why anything exists at all doesn't make sense because we can't imagine what nothing is. But you think it's actually a valid question, even though we get wild and diverse answers, it's still a legitimate philosophical and scientific question.
Well, I think insofar as I've given a wild and speculative answer to it, it must be a meaningful question. Either that or my answer is meaningless. I think on this question of do we really have a conception of nothingness, I don't know. I'm not sure that we do really have a conception of nothingness. So I'm sympathetic to the view that says, look, this question is somehow, there's something flawed about it. But I come back to it, you know, as far as I've just given what I think is a meaningful answer to it, I think actually the question must make sense.
So what you initially saying about the, just to clarify some points here, the vacuum being constantly there now, obviously that's another problem when we come to defining nothing, because lo and behold, we find that although the vacuum constitutes nothing in what we understand as a physical sense, it still has properties and structures. So it's not really nothing, which most people can see how that at least makes some form of sense. But if the whole universe comes from the structure of the vacuum, is the vacuum, even though it's not nothing, is it always there as a type of a infinite backdrop, as it was in the classical sense?
I think if correct sense state of the universe is the vacuum state, I think it's very hard to understand that statement other than in many worlds theory. So because, you know, the entire universe seems to be to contain, you know, very large numbers of particles, the vacuum state is a zero particle state. So I think there's a lot of subtleties in this, and I don't think it's going to be easy to convey this to non-experts. But one aspect to it is that the vacuum that I'm talking about arises in a so-called particle representation of a quantum field theory. And one reason to understand how it can be that this vacuum state is nevertheless structured is think of a quantum field as being like a harmonic oscillator, something that's vibrating, but there's a continuous infinity of such harmonic oscillators corresponding to the continuous infinity of frequencies. And ask yourself in quantum mechanics, what is the ground state of a harmonic oscillator? Classically, of course, the ground state of a harmonic oscillator will be something that, think of a pendulum or something, it'll just be hanging straight down and momentum position fixed. But of course, precisely that state of affairs, momentum equal to zero, a particular location, a particular position, and now I'm thinking of something like a pendulum, would violate the uncertainty relationships. So you can start to see why in quantum mechanics you just can't get to the minimal thing in classical physics. Okay, so that was just an attempt to make it a little bit more intelligible how it is that simply can't define the state of a quantum field in which there's, as we're really nothing. You know, I mean, perhaps one would think of it like a classical electromagnetic field. The state of that would just be the field intensity is zero everywhere. But the field intensity being zero everywhere is a bit like a pendulum bob just hanging straight down and not moving. That isn't definable given the uncertainty relationship. But anyway, I come back to it. So that vacuum state, whilst it's got global properties, the global property of being the zero particle state. Talk of numbers of particles in relativistic quantum theory just is global. It can't be avoided. You can't define it in terms of local operators and eigenvalues of local operators, where operators correspond to measurable quantities. So the universe that we see with all of the particles in it would be locally defined, and as such consistent with the fact that the global numbers of particles are zero. And you get superpositions of such states, build up sufficient numbers of superpositions, the net result is the zero. And another way to think of this perhaps is that the actual universe that we see is extremely complex. But if you are going to describe all possible universes, actually that description can be quite simple. Let's see, what would be a simple example? A particular melody may be quite a complex thing. A musician might have to struggle for a long time to construct that melody. And then you can digitalize that melody, put it in a digital form. It's going to be sequences of numbers. Typically zeros and ones, binary or whatever. But now just consider, I can describe all possible sequences of zeros and ones in a way I've just done it. I mean, up to choose a large N, a few trillion or, thousands of trillions, whatever. And just all sequences of zeros and ones that are a few thousand trillion digits in length. So in a way, just describe that thing. So in a way, I've just described all possible melodies. And I've done it very easy. I didn't have to think about it. So when you've got combinations of all possibilities, you can end up with something very simple, even though each of the possibilities is something extremely complex and structured.
Thank you, Simon. Just change track, if you'd like to start to address some aspects of probability and necessity and how we can think about this, either in a single universe, a multiverse, or all the different possible worlds. So how is the existence of either our single universe or a multiverse probable, or is it necessary, and what are some of the problems conceptually that affects probability and necessity when we apply this to any form of existence at all?
I've spoken a bit about necessity already. I think probability is the newcomer now on the table. And of course, probability is pretty central to quantum mechanics. So one needs to say something about what quantum mechanical probability is. But quantum mechanical probability isn't the only kind of probability. So perhaps let's just start off with distinguishing two kinds of probability. One, whatever quantum mechanics is giving us. There perhaps is another kind of probability out there the world bound up with other physical theories. One might believe that. I actually don't think there is. I don't actually think we've got any evidence that any other kind of objective probability out there in the world other than quantum mechanical probability. Okay, but then there's a third kind of probability, which is bound up with degrees of belief. And this third kind of probability is often called credence by philosophers to try to distinguish it from the first kind, which is sometimes called chance, objective chance. So perhaps distinguish credence from chance. Both kinds of probability have been intense interest to philosophers, and physicists, of course, have had to do with the the chance part of the equation. But philosophers have found it much easier to make headway with credence and understanding credence than they have with understanding objective chance. Because credence, degrees of belief, is very intimately connected with rational conduct. And starting from the late 20s with Frank Ramsey, and then continued by De Finetti in the 30s, and there have been other people working in the 50s, in particular Savage, the American mathematician. So what these guys showed is that if you're going to have degrees of belief and those degrees of belief are constrained by what look like rational axioms, so in the sense of, take transitivity, if you prefer A to B and you prefer B to C, then you better prefer A to C. That's the transitive preferences of a rational agent. And it would seem that it would be very odd to act in such a way that were not true. And in a way, it's almost definitive of what we mean to act rationally. And amazingly, it turns out that given that an individual will have whatever utilities they have, things that they value, things that they don't value, different people will have different utilities. And you are rational in how you choose among possible courses of action. And when I say that you're rational about it, meaning that you obey these axioms of rationality, like transitivity of preferences. So if you do that, then you will de facto prioritize one action over another action, and there'll be a large range of possible actions now. You will order that large number of possible actions according to which you prefer over each other, as if maximizing expected utility. Now, there's two aspects to that. One, the utility, that there's going to be these quantitative values that you can place on certain kinds of outcome. And two, that you're going to maximize expected utility. And that means that you will de facto be assigning degrees of belief to those outcomes taking place. And those degrees of belief that you will assign will obey the axioms of probability theory. So this is very remarkable, these representation theorems. To get a grip on how on earth one could arrive at such a thing, you need to look at the very simplified ones that Frank Ramsey, for example, first wrote down to do with Dutch book arguments. You know, that if you have degrees of belief, you assign degrees of belief outside of the interval 0 to 1, maybe you have some negative degrees of belief. I mean, this is in the form of a calculus, in a betting scenario. So if I'm going to place a bet, there's a certain financial value to that bet. And now I'm going to work out my odds. And if I'm going to start assigning negative numbers to those odds, that's what I mean by negative probabilities, then you can prove that there's a way of that your opponent or your co-player will always win. So in order to prevent that happening, you leave between 0 and 1. And it's a very simple argument. It's a beautiful argument, actually. But I think one really needs to write it down. It's hard to speak it out in words. And similarly, you can argue that these degrees of belief had better be additive over disjoint outcomes. The conditionalization that the probability of your degree of belief in A conditional on B is going to be your degree of belief on A and B divided by your degree of belief on B. So you can prove that, you know, the basics of probability theory just drop out of acting in a rational way, and in this case, in the way that Ramsey set it up, in terms of betting scenarios, that you won't act in such a way that you're bound to lose. Okay, so that's all on the credence side. So philosophers made a lot of progress on that. I think it's one of the real achievements, actually, in philosophy, that we understand so well the close connection between credence, degrees of belief, and rational action. Now go to the other component, objective chance, and now it's an altogether different story. And first and foremost, if one thinks that objective chance is some physical quantity, some, you know, part of the external universe, the reality out there, as it were, nothing to do with my head, it's something, you know, governing the way matter behaves, radiation behaves, and so forth, then why is it that that physical quantity should dictate our credences? And dictate it seems to. If a physicist tells me that the objective chance of a radioactive decay taking place and some instrument registering that decay process, a Geiger counter or whatever, or a blip on a fluorescent screen or a bubble in a cloud chamber. And the physicist tells me that that's going to happen with objective chance 0.1 in the next 5 minutes, but objective chance 0.99 within an hour. Then I'll bet a lot of money. How much exactly? Well, we can talk about that. The blip will be observed within an hour. I will tailor my degrees of belief to what the physicist tells me the objective chance is. And what's so puzzling about that is just all of the stuff I've been saying about credences and its connection with rationality. How is it that the value of some physical quantity can so impact on what is on rational deliberation? And the rational deliberation isn't really about, you know, some evidence, you know, some the blip itself. It's this chance. It's the chance that dictates what my credence is. But what is that chance? What is it as a physical quantity? What is chance as a physical quantity? Not the events that come about through chance, but chance itself. And it's very hard to imagine what chance could be such that it ought to and can be rationally understood as determining my degrees of belief. That seems extraordinary. I mean, imagine it like this. I mean, Popper came up with propensity theory of interpretation and probability. There are these propensities out there in the world. Fine. So then you think, well, the propensity is whatever, 0.3. Okay, fine. So why is it that that propensity being 0.3 should dictate my degrees of belief about something else? You know, what that propensity is going to do is trigger some chance event that produces a blip on the screen. So why is my rational belief about the blip on the screen got anything to do with this propensity? And how can I even address that question? How can I even know how to think about it unless you tell me in more detail what a propensity is, physically, what it is? This feeds into a lot of other things about chance that perhaps we're sort of very familiar with and they don't strike us as puzzling, but when you think about them, they're just incredibly puzzling. Why aren't there good luck charms? Why not? You know, why isn't there a probability meter? Why isn't there a meter that can just sort of measure this thing called chance directly? You just, you know, couple it up. We measure all kinds of other things in physics. Why can't we measure chances? And why is it that now looking at we actually get any leverage on chances? Why is it that we take as evidence for what chances are relative frequencies of outcomes on, you know, repeat performances of a chance setup, you know, create a chance setup, a machine that flips a coin, say, and you get an outcome, heads. Do it again, get another outcome, this time it's tails. You know, and you're going and you gradually build up relative frequencies of heads, you know, in a long run of throws of the coin, and then we say, oh, well, that relative frequency, that's evidence for what the chance is. But actually there we even fail to get it right, because the correct statement to make is that that relative frequency is with high probability evidence, with high chance evidence for what the chance is. So you've still got the problem, well, what does that do? And why should I, you know, allow that to impact on my degrees of belief in the ways that it seems that we do let it impact on our degrees?
If I could just clarify one point there. So essentially what you're saying with that issue of probability is that people that say that there is a 0.3% chance of phenomenon X occurring are collapsing some kind of current into chance in itself, as where you're saying, what is the actual quantification of chance itself in an objective world? They're not, by definition, the same. They should be separated out a bit. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I was saying a bit more than that. But here's perhaps another way of putting it. Take a world in which there's a certain radioactive decay process, and maybe it's a very rare process. Maybe it concerns a very exotic nucleus that is so unstable that it never really... Or the cross-section for producing it is somehow so extraordinarily small that it never gets produced. Maybe there's only a handful of these atoms ever produced. They talk about a plateau of stability of nuclear structures out in the somehow the 140s or so atomic number. So maybe it's one of those out there. We've never seen such a thing. Maybe we'll never produce such a thing. But maybe it exists somewhere. And maybe it decays with some probability. And okay, fine. We now have the decay product. Now, what was it about the universe that made that probability what it was? What is it about the universe that made the chance, you know, its lifetime for decay, whatever it was, rather than something else? And there's just nothing, it seems, that I can measure directly. There's just nothing, I just don't have a story as to what is that chance, that what is it about the universe that made it that that was the probability rather than something else, than it being out some other probability. And all of the ways in which we connect with these objective chances is through measuring relative frequencies, but actually we can't identify the objective probabilities with those relative frequencies for a host of reasons, but we can't even say that the relative frequency is going to approximate the chance. We can't even say that this is how we actually measure the chance. That what we can say is with chance close to one, in the limit of large numbers, the relative frequencies equal the chance that we're interested in. So that's how we measure, you know, we measure through repeated operations and building up these patterns and the statistical data. But then it's all of it qualified by with chance close to one, that statistical data is telling us what the chances are. So it's a very remarkable thing. I hope that. It is. It's totally baffling. And it's only through familiarity that people aren't baffled by it. I mean, I think you see this as well if you look at the history of the early period of quantum mechanics. People just couldn't get their head around the idea that there could be objective chance out there. You know, Einstein famously saying that God does not play dice and so forth. I mean, what on earth does it mean for there to be objective chance in the world? Okay, so that's all a large philosophical background, and any philosopher involved at all in metaphysics and epistemology sooner or later has to deal with probability, and it has defeated many, many, many a mind, and very few people seem to have made any headway at all with it. Okay, but now along comes the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, and I really think the many worlds interpretation has changed all of that. Whether or not it's true, we now have a theory, and as it were, a possible universe or a possible multiverse, in which, you know, such theory, let's suppose, is true, in which one really explains not only what objective chance is, but why we have the kind of access to it that we do, and why it connects with credence in the way that we want it to. So all of these things are really explained. I mean, and I do think this is an extraordinary achievement. I think if it were not the case, if this was an entirely imaginary theory, you know, not quantum mechanics at all, but just some other theory, entirely imaginary, you know, as a sort of a toy model to say, look, it's not that chance can't be understood. Here's a way in which it could be understood if such a theory were true. If it had been presented like that, I think in some ways it would have got a better press. But it's not presented like that. Instead, it's presented as the solution to the measurement problem of quantum mechanics and the interpretation of quantum theory that we know and love. And that is so polarizing and divisive within the philosophy community that, in a sense, people can't get past that to look at actually what an extraordinary achievement it is that within this theory, this interpretation of quantum theory, one can really give a wholly transparent account of the nature of chance. Okay, so there's one qualification in all of that, one, you know, what is it, grit, so, you know, something that's not entirely satisfactory, which is to do with the notion of uncertainty. I'll come on to that in a minute. Let me just first say what objective chance is according to the many worlds theory. It's branching. Chance events involve branching structure. So wherever there is branching structure in the quantum state, that is what we have always been interpreting as or experiencing as a probabilistic event, one of Popper's propensity events. So it's actually this branching structure. So what is branching structure? I think the many worlds picture is fairly straightforward in a way, in that there's lots of images one can use. Just think of a tree-like structure, where the trunk of the tree is, you know, prior to branching, and where, you know, with every branch, this thing is completely familiar to us. Or think of Borges, his short story, was it, I think, I forget the title now, but A Thousand, Garden of a Thousand Paths or something. Anyway, the idea that you've got different realities, a reality which, where there become two possible realities and both of those realities are real, but we are only experiencing one of them. One can't simultaneously inhabit two of those realities. I mean, that's very mind-boggling perhaps, but I think we can kind of get the idea of what's being suggested. So when I talk about a branching structure to the quantum state, I mean something very much like that, where each branch is a history of the sorts of things that we ordinarily see. And where there is a divide, where there is branching, that indicates a probabilistic event has taken place. So that's what objective chances or chance events are, their branching structure. And this branching structure, by the way, evolves according to deterministic laws. We have the equations for it. These are the equations we know and love in quantum mechanics, the Schrodinger equation, the so-called unitary evolution. Okay, so that's what chance events are. The quantitative values of the chances are the modulus square of the amplitudes of the relevant branches. So if I have a branch which branches into, say, four or five branches, each of those branches that it branches into has an amplitude. The original branch I started with had an amplitude. If I look at the modulus square of the amplitudes of all of the branches that the thing branches into, they sum to one. That's part of the unitary equations of quantum mechanics that dictate that that is the case. And they function just like the quantitative values of the chances. Okay, so that's what objective chance is and what chance events are. And now that we know what it is in these, in a way that we can deal with it, we've got equations, we've got laws, we know what the structure of the quantum state is. We know how measuring systems operate. We can represent those in quantum mechanics as well. And now we can figure out what can and cannot be of these modulus squares of these amplitudes. How can they be correlated with something like a measurement display, a dial that gives you numbers? We can study this as a dynamical problem. And what we find is that it's exactly in accordance with what we always thought was going on. I mean, we know that to measure objective chance, we have to look at statistics, and what we then arrive at is with high objective chance, the statistics will give us whatever the objective chance of each of the events going into the statistics. And that's what is delivered by this dynamical analysis. Dynamically, you can now show that a branch can contain records of repeat experiments. The relative frequencies of such are close to the amplitude squared of the outcome we've been interested in and collecting the data about. But in the sense that with high amplitude, that measuring instrument will exist on a branch with high amplitude, such that the relative frequencies it records equals the modulus square of the amplitudes of the system that we're interested in, the events that we're interested in, a quantum coin being tossed or something like that. There are also going to be branches with relative frequencies that do not match the amplitude squared of the quantum coin tossing. But those branches have very low amplitudes, very small amplitudes. So that's a sort of dynamical explanation of what what we've always been doing when we've been, quotes unquote, measuring chances through collecting statistics and so forth. And more than that, you can ask, well, why not a probability meter that measures the amplitude directly? Why can't that exist? And you can just very easily show that it's contrary to dynamical laws. And similarly with good luck charms and luck potions and so forth, you can show dynamically why there couldn't exist such things. Now, all of that, I think, is very nice. It's tremendous. I mean, I think it's better than anything we've ever had. But even more, we can now make the connection with credence and rational behavior. What you can show, and this is a bit like the Savage axioms, the representation theorems that I was mentioning before, whereby a rational actor will obey certain kinds of axioms, in decision theory, in how they go about choosing preferences among possible actions. They will do so as if calculating expected utilities for the outcomes and then choosing the one which has the maximum expected utility. Okay, so I said that was the case within classical theory of credence and very beautiful theorems and so on and so forth. But what those things don't do is give you unique subjective degrees of belief. Every rational actor will have his or her own set of degrees of belief. They will obey the probability calculus, but you can't get out a representation theorem such that a rational actor will give a particular degree of belief to some particular action. So that's impossible classically. Nothing like that exists classically. Do something in quantum mechanics and the many worlds interpretation, and amazingly, it's not just that the rational actor will act as though maximizing expected degrees of belief, but they will use as their subjective degrees of belief. Sorry, did I say? I think I misspoke. As in the classical case, a rational actor will act as to maximize their expected utilities. But not only that, now they will use subjective degrees of belief for outcomes that are the modulus squares of the amplitudes. And that is truly incredible. I mean, that is a very remarkable theorem, and it is a theorem. As a theorem, there are postulates, there are axioms, and some of them are clear rationality axioms. Other of the axioms concern the nature of branching structure in quantum mechanics. And these are not axioms of rationality. They're just, axioms stating this is how the world is, according to the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory. And given that that's the way the world is, don't try to do the following. Okay, and here's the sort of thing that a rational actor should not try to do. Don't try to choose those actions where there's exactly 11 branching processes going on rather than 15 branching processes going on. Why not? Because there are billions and billions of branching processes going on all the time, and we just can't keep track of them. We're just not able to actually figure out what the detailed branchings are, how many branchings there are. It's just beyond our capacities to function in that way. It's a bit like, there's a very nice metaphor from one of my friends and colleagues, David Wallace, who was very instrumental in developing these theorems. David Deutsch initially was the author, but David Wallace did a great deal both of cleaning up and making clear precisely what was going into these representation theorems. And so he gave the example, it's a bit like, do you want to try to date girls with only a prime number of molecules in their body? That's just a very bad dating strategy. It's a dating strategy that you couldn't possibly put to use. There's just no way that one can find out, sort of thing, right? Okay, so there's a few, there's two or three axioms of that sort. But then given that a rational agent does satisfy those axioms in how he or she goes about ordering their preferences, they will act, and of course they've got to know now I'm going to seem like I contradicted myself. It's not a contradiction, but they're going to have to know what the branching structure is as dictated by amplitudes, that for such and such an outcome will have such and such an amplitude. If they know that, then they will act as though maximizing their expected utilities using for their subjective degrees of belief the modulus squares of the relevant amplitudes. Okay, that's called the Born rule. The Born rule is the rule that quantum mechanics came with right from the beginning, about 26, 1927, whereby the objective chances are calculated from the theoretical quantities, the quantum state, in terms of modulus square of the amplitudes of components of the state. So the Born rule becomes how a rational actor will use the Born rule in negotiating their way through this branching structure, supposing they know what the quantum state is. And they must use the Born rule if they're to be rational in the terms of these axiom systems. So, right, that's a very long and complicated answer to the question, but I hope it makes sense. Problem, something that perhaps is more difficult to evaluate, is the nature of uncertainty. What is the connection between all of this and these degrees of belief, indeed, on the subjective side and on the objective side, the chances? What is the connection with uncertainty? Probability is always bound up somehow with uncertainty, and uncertainty seems always to be bound up with ignorance. So what is it that one is ignorant of, giving this branch of structure to the quantum state, given that it obeys the deterministic laws, the equations, the Schrodinger equation, and so forth? It seems that we know everything there is to know. What further information do we need, or could we have, or could we lack, such that one could be ignorant about anything and such that one can be uncertain of anything? Okay, so there is an answer to this, but it's a controversial one. And the answer is, what we're uncertain about and what we're ignorant of is where we are located within this branching structure. And what's necessary to really make this fly is that when I ask that question, where am I located, what I mean by I isn't a momentary thing. It's an entire person from cradle to grave. I don't know who that, what one of those I am. I know what one of those I am up to a point, from cradle up to, you know, the present, or at least roughly I do. But of course, the zillions that are like that, you know, from cradle up to where I am now, it's what I'm like afterwards that I don't know, or which I am afterwards that I don't know. I don't know what complete life I am. That's a way of putting it. And I can't know what complete life I am is mine. And that's what I'm uncertain about. And whenever there's an issue of a quantum mechanical event taking place, I don't know which life is mine of those that come from the various outcomes. For each outcome, there'll be a different life, a different person. That's what Many Worlds is about. Sorry about that, but you just got to bite that bullet. And I just don't know which one is mine. So there's the uncertainty, and there is and the associated ignorance. But as I say, that's controversial. People say, well, you know, that's not really what I ordinarily mean when I ask what will happen, or what will happen to me. I don't mean by that which life is mine. I mean something else. You know, so you can always, there's a lot of fuzziness about what these sorts of questions really mean and how we're supposed to think of ourselves. Just about temporal issues in general that arises independent of quantum mechanics altogether. So I think one of the lessons of the Many Worlds interpretation of quantum theory is that it most of the problems that arise with it, the conceptual problems, are already pre-existing. I mean, they arise anyway without Many Worlds quantum theory. But Many Worlds quantum theory casts those conceptual questions in a very stark form. And in some ways, that's a virtue of the theory. You know, questions that we perhaps always worry about when we don't really know whether we need to deal with them. In Many Worlds theory, it seems that you perhaps do need to deal with them.
When you put it all like that, I can see how probability becomes very problematic in itself. Just to summarise and conclude some points, would you like to just run through and just highlight the most fundamental issues you think we should address when we start to address why does anything exist at all, from quantum mechanics to different versions of probability to possibly necessarily existent entities like mathematics? What if I were to come to you and go, Simon, give me the rundown, what questions we should consider when we try to even ask why does anything exist at all? How would you generally give us a summary to conclude and to think about?
I think that there's degrees of how extreme is that question. Posed in its most extreme form, it's also asking, why are there any laws at all? Why isn't there nothing in the sense of a complete absence of laws as equally as a complete absence of things? And I think one can address that, but only through a pretty wild speculative notion that mathematical structures exist necessarily. A mathematical structure can have all of the attributes of reality that we think the world ordinarily has. So there is a way to go, which I think shows that the question can't be meaningless. But as I say, that's virtually the only way I know to go to that very extreme form of the question. I'm kind of prepared to believe that reality is a mathematical structure, but I find it very, very hard to believe that all possible mathematical structures exist. So one of the problems with believing that reality is a mathematical structure is, well, why uniquely that mathematical structure and not some other mathematical structure? So, I mean, if mathematical structures exist necessarily, okay, this one exists necessarily, but then what about the other ones? Don't they exist necessarily too? So you can see why it kind of comes as a package. You sort of have to buy into all mathematical structures existing, at least insofar as one's to make any headway with the question of why is there something rather than nothing. Okay, so, but a less extreme version of the question will say, well, okay, I'll allow things like dimensionality of space and time. So when I say why is there something rather than nothing, I'm imagining the alternative is just empty space. And now I think quantum mechanics does make a difference. Reality is governed not by Euclidean geometry and time and Newtonian particle physics. If it were, then, you know, complete vacuum, no particles, you've still got space-time, that makes sense. But instead, it's governed by quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, relativistic quantum theory. And then within that theory, you try to get to the state of nothingness. And actually, what you end up with, the vacuum state, is something with extraordinary structure. And it may be, it contains all possible universes of the sort that we see, and ours among them. So I think one does make progress then with that question that way. Bringing in quantum mechanics, of course, also brings in probability. And in the many worlds interpretation, I think the nature of probability as an objective thing out there in reality is extraordinarily clear and precise, and one is able to reason with it in ways that one can't otherwise, because otherwise one never really knows what objective probability is. It's just a measure on some space, and one doesn't know what that measure physically means. But in the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, you do. And one of the aspects to that, actually, is that the probabilistic events of branching structure and the chances are the amplitude squared. These amplitudes in the branching structure is something existent. It's not something that exists in some sort of limbo. It's not a sort of a potentiality or something. It's just existent in the same way that masses and charges and spatially structured things exist. Not in some state of potentiality or anything like that. So there's something very clear-cut about what the objective chances are in terms of existing structures. It's not that they bring about existence, they are already existent. And the chances, in what sense are those really probabilities? Well, they behave just like real probabilities. We measure them just like real probabilities. We can't measure them just like we can't measure real probabilities, you know, in the ways that I've spoken about. And because it connects with rational degrees of belief, necessarily, given certain axioms of decision theory and given pragmatic constraints on what it is possible to do, given this branching structure. So probability, I think, ceases to be something mysterious. It becomes a part of existent reality. Credence, I think we understand why it has obeys the axioms of probability that it does and why it connects to these objective chance. It's hard to get a cleaner analysis, modulo this question of uncertainty, perhaps. It's hard to get a cleaner analysis, to imagine a cleaner analysis and a more comprehensive analysis of probability. Whether there's any other ballpark of notions of credence, for example, which might connect with the why is there something rather than nothing, I don't really see it. I mean, one, of course, can have subjective degrees of belief about why existence exists, why there are these things, but I don't really see any scientific control on what those degrees of belief are unless they go through one of the philosophical kinds of analyses that I've already given, or perhaps connecting through the necessity of mathematical structures. I don't think there's any other notion of credence, why it's somehow reasonable to believe that there should be something rather than nothing. I find that I don't really see any other role for probability in this debate.